The world isn't wide enough. Get immersed in the expansive views of the 48-inch customizable panoramic display in the all-new 2024 Lincoln Nautilus Hybrid. Explore more at Lincoln.com. Some models, trims, and features may not be available or may be subject to change. Check with your local retailer for current information. Lincoln and Nautilus are trademarks of Ford or its affiliates.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Welcome to the Bike Radar Podcast, brought to you by the team behind BikeRadar.com, Cycling Plus, and MBUK magazines. If you enjoy this episode, please subscribe. And if you can do so, leave us a rating on your podcast provider of choice. It really helps us reach other cyclists like you.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Bike Radar Podcast. Today we have another Bike of the Year special, and today we're going to talk about road and gravel. My name is Simon Von Bromley. I'll be your host today, and I am joined by Ashley Quinlan, our Senior Technical Editor for Road, Warren Roster, another of our Senior Technical Editors for Road, and Catherine Moore, a lovely freelancer who did our women's category. How is everyone today? How are you doing, Catherine?
I'm very well, thank you.
Thanks for joining us. How have you been?
Yeah, good. I would say soaking up the rays in the southwest, but it has been rather wet. Yeah,
it has.
So just trying to stay afloat, really.
Ash, all good with you?
Yeah, not too bad. Just got off the back of a week holiday, so I've jumped straight back at the pod studio. Now I'm trying to remember everything I wrote about Bike of the Year about 3 weeks ago, as the calendar goes. So,
well, no better time to remember it than now, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You put me on the line. It's all good.
And was everything good?
Yeah, very good. Finally, seeing the light at the end of the tunnel for the massiveness that is Bike of the Year.
And we'll get ready to start all again in a week or so.
Yeah, we're already starting to look in for 2024 Bike.
That's why it sounds so exasperating.
Yeah. Never ending, a Sisyphean task this, isn't it? Right, let's get straight into it. We'll start off with gravel, as it is one of the big and up-and-coming categories. Now, who tested this for us?
Warren.
That would be me.
That would be you, Warren. So, any comments on the kind of general category to make? What kind of bikes did you call in this year? And how did you test them? What kind of things were you looking for?
Well, I mean, for gravel, it's a really hugely broad, masses of variation. You know, I've got everything from kind of all road, pure gravel, road bike kind of hybrids, aero gravel racer is now a thing, and then you've got the more kind of gravity influenced mountain bike influenced side of things. So gravel has just become so expansive that, as much as it pains me to say, for 2024 I'm going to be arguing for more than one gravel category to give myself even more work. So for this year's test, each bike has been ridden on some of my favorite Salisbury Plain loops. That takes in everything from kind of short steep rides with plenty of kind of technical trail, right up to the longest one I took every bike on is a 75-mile gravel loop out over Salisbury Plain, which is a big militarized area in the UK, which has no tarmac roads and no houses. It's fabulous. And that goes out to the World Heritage Site of Stonehenge and back. So my kind of take on gravel is that the bikes have to be good at everything. You know, the big wide open graded road, you know, is one thing. That's a you know, an element of gravel racing that we're seeing more and more of. But I also think it needs to be good at byways, bridleways, double track, technical single track, plenty of elevation, and, you know, be able to cope with what is the kind of British gravel experience, I would say.
So what kind of bikes did you have on test, Warren? And we'll obviously talk about the winner in a bit, but which two were the kind of third and second place bikes?
This year I wanted to try and kind of represent a fairly broad spectrum of what's out there. So we had BMC's Chaos 01, which is effectively BMC's team machine with big tyre clearances.
Yeah, it's just a road bike with really big tyre clearances.
And very narrow bar.
Which is great for me, but obviously, yeah, not to everyone's taste, right?
And then you had an even, you know, arguably even more extreme Factor Austro Gravel, which is basically a Factor Austro with big tyre clearances. So that, I kind of got those just to represent that kind of high-end race orientated area. And then the Ridley Kanzo Adventure, which is like a big monster truck of a gravel bike.
It's a big bike, that. It really is. I know you ride 58 centimeter frames, but that's
big for,
still...
It was big for 58.
That's a chunky bike.
But it's got all the fixtures and fittings you could ever want on it, you know, and it's very, very off-road capable, which is kind of a lot of fun. Then I had the Pivot Volt, which sort of coming a little bit left field, I would say, which had geometry somewhere between the Ridley and the Factor, but it's got a sort of Suedo suspension system on the back, very capable bike. And then finally, a variation on last year's gravel bike of the year, the Giant Revolt, and it's the new Giant Revolt X, which takes the Revolt frame, slightly relaxes the geometry, puts a suspension fork up front, puts a dropper post out back, and again, just a really good, capable bike. From that five, and I have to say, actually, it wasn't, I actually had like about a dozen gravel bikes in. I shrunk it down to five for the constraints of the test. But, and then out of that five, the top three, it was the Ridley, the Pivot, and the Giant.
Why did the bikes that not make the cut? What, you know, is there anything particular about those, or is it just not the kind of the right, just didn't quite hit the same heights?
I think they are kind of racing tools for a job.
Mm.
In that, if you're doing a particular, like a Midwest, you know, epic 200k gravel race on fairly well graded roads, or kind of like Princess Gravel in the UK, sort
UCI
of thing,
World Championship,
yeah, exactly,
gravel,
yeah, they would be epically good, so fast, stiff, do everything for it. But the minute you're on less optimum surfaces, where you're starting to get a bit of ruts, you're getting that kind of tractor barring, or you know, when it runs into double track or anything like that, or you're getting any kind of sheep furrow kind of things, they're absolutely out of their depth. They're as out of their depth as there would be to take, you know, a Cervelo S5
sure
down single track. They just felt that out of whack of what they did. So as pure tools for the job, if that's what your gravel interests are, they're great examples. It's just for the wide world of gravel, they were a bit limited.
Okay, so what is it about then that kind of top three that stood out?
Ridley Kanzo, I think, has this sort of monster truck-like ability just to roll over everything. It's not fast, but it's very forgiving. It's extremely stable. And when I was riding that, there was nothing I would look ahead and go, oh, that could be a bit sketchy. On that, you just go, no, let's just motor on and just plow through it. You know, it's just, it just rolls over everything. And for the bike packer who likes a little bit of way off piste riding, I can't think of a better bike out there right now for that sort of thing. With the Pivot, you've got sporty, almost racy geometry like the BMC and like the Factor. But whereas the BMC and the Factor kind of get undone by their lightness and stiffness, the Pivot has a kind of double sleeve seat post arrangement, which effectively is like a suspension at the back, which takes the edge off, and it's a comfortable ride. And the front end of that, they've balanced out really well. So you kind of got this racy ride position with the comfort that's going to keep you fresher for longer, as it were. And then finally, the Revolt mashes everything together, adds in a layer of a suspension fork and a dropper post, and it just makes a ridiculously exciting and fun bike. I mean, on the same kind of, you know, the 75 mile loop that I was doing on the big flat straight out sections, the BMC and the Factor were easily the fastest bikes I rode, you know, like data backs up. But the fastest over the full loop was the Giant. And that's because when you hit single track, when you hit double track, when you hit the descents, when you hit the technical stuff, you don't have to back down. You can just keep on. And it was ridiculous, you know. It's a bike that when I was out riding, if I'd ride like a particularly technical piece of trail or a descent or anything like that, I get to the bottom and I'll go, God, that was so much fun. I'm going back, I'm doing it again, you know. So I don't think I'd win any events on it because I'd be more interested in having fun. And I think for me, that's what gravel should always be about. It's the fun of not having to deal with traffic and not having to deal with, you know, almost like, I don't have to deal with all those kind of competitive elements. It's just getting out in the wild and having a big fun time, you know.
Okay, and which was your winner?
Unsurprisingly, it was the Revolt X.
Yeah.
I mean, it just hits the right marks on price, performance, and it's just got the biggest fun factor.
Well, there you go. So we're going to quickly move on to the value category next, which was tested by Robin Wilmot, who cannot be here with us today, but I believe, Woz, you have some of his notes for us.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I've worked with Robin for a couple of decades now. He's quite local to me. So whilst he was out testing his value road bikes, I quite often bumped into him, sometimes on purpose, go for coffee, etc. just, you know, to have a chat and everything. And his top three, Marin Gestalt, which is under £1,000, the new Lapierre Cross Hill 2.0 at £1,200, and then Cannondale's CAD Optimo 1 at £1,300. And Robin kind of set out to do this test as a kind of a value bike like that. You're going to use it for, you know, your big rides. You're going to use it for your sportives, et cetera, but you're also more than likely going to be using it as a commuter and a run around and that sort of thing. So he was doing a lot of that stuff. He was putting a tag along on the back to ride one of his boys to school. He was, you know, riding to and from work on it and also getting out weekends on all these bikes. So they need to be like proper workhorses, but that doesn't necessarily mean they need to be boring. You know, and I think, you know, the Gestalt is sort of occupying that near gravel space. Really good, typical Marin, you know, great value, nicely put together, sorted geometry. Lapierre Cross Hill, again, it's kind of approaching that kind of gravel space. And the Cannondale Optimo 1 is really the pure road bike there, and it had rim brakes. And Robin just came back with that, and he said it's exceptionally good at what it's done and the way it's been pitched, and it's basically it's a CAD 13 light, and you know that's one hell of a bike to be living up to.
And do we still think, kind of, you know, if we're talking about value road bikes, are rim brakes still an appealing option that people should be looking at, or would we worry about being kind of locked into a, you know, an obsolete system?
I mean, you know, rim brake spares are going to be around for a long time.
Yeah.
They absolutely are. So I wouldn't worry too much about it unless you're looking to buy a bike that eventually, for some reason, you're going to want to upgrade and upgrade and upgrade. But as a good everyday workhorse bike that's easy to live with, easy to maintain, then rim brakes should still be a factor. They should still be an option. And also it means that you get a higher grade of group set than you would if you went disc, which is certainly true of the Optima.
And so which of those three bikes came third and second?
To be honest, it was very difficult to split the Gestalt and the Crosshill. You know, the Gestalt, because of the price point it's managed to get under, makes it very, very attractive. The Lapierre probably does have the bit of the edge, you know, but you know, we couldn't split them, so we kind of, you know, it's a dead heat.
Fair enough.
And minor places.
And which bike won?
The CAD Optimo 1.
The CAD Optimo 1. Okay, well, I think that does look like a fantastic bike. And yeah, certainly if you're looking for a kind of value road bike, then as you say, like, it does appear to have that kind of, you know, classic Cannondale CAD magic behind it. And I know, you know, obviously the CAD 13 still exists in kind of disc brake form, but if you wanted the simplicity and the value of rim brakes, then this looks like a great model.
It's worth saying, when we went to shoot it as well for our cover shots for the magazine, which will be available now in all good newsstands. You know, it didn't look out of place. You know, there's the performance bike I'm riding. There's the aero bike that you tested, Simon, and it doesn't look out of place amongst those bikes. So why not?
Fantastic. Right. So let's move on to the women's category. Now, any kind of general comments to make on this category, Catherine? How did you decide? How did we decide what bikes to call in for it, for example? And what bikes did you end up testing?
So that's a really good question, because I think we could have a whole podcast episode just about, like, what makes a women's bike.
Yeah,
is there a case in these days for a women's bike? Like, all of the bikes that I ride personally are unisex bikes with some adjustments, admittedly, but I've also got on really well with some women-specific bikes, women-specific geometries, for example. So it's quite an interesting category. And I think over the last sort of 4 or 5 years, we've seen a huge decrease in the number of women's bikes that are available, especially at the sort of like mid to top end. So there wasn't a huge number of different ones that we could consider calling in. But what we've also seen in the last few years, which I think is great, is more bike brands allowing you to customize your build. So like the Old Bears and the Ribbles. So you can actually get what you want from the get-go, and you don't have to pay for stuff that you're just going to switch out immediately. So for the first time this year, we included a bike which was unisex, so the Ribble CGR, and that was spec'd to make it more suitable for the female rider. We also included the Scott Contessa Addict 25. So that's one of Scott's women's bikes that does, again, have a unisex frame, but is built up with contact points to suit female riders. And the Livered Veil Advanced 1. So that's right, you know, from the get-go in terms of geometry based on body dimension data that Livered collected, women's specific geometry. So that's like really at the sort of dedicated end of that spectrum. So three quite different bikes. Also, for the first time this year, we had a titanium bike, which we haven't had in women's category before, with the CGR. And again, that's a slight sort of wild card for this category in that it's not a pure road bike. CGR standing for cross gravel road. But it was set up in sort of road specification. So yeah, slightly different for this year. We were, I think, quite lucky in terms of getting hold of bikes to test was a bit easier this year compared to last. Whereas last year we had like a real range from like a real sort of budget to really something quite fancy. It was much more achievable to get them within a better price bracket. So we had the Scott Contessa Addict 25 at $2,500. The Ribble CGR TI Enthusiast with a few modifications coming in at $4,500, and then the Livered Veil Advanced One in between that, just over $3,500. So they were all either Shimano 105 or Shimano 105 DI2, so kind of within the same sort of bracket.
And how did you test, and what kind of things were you looking for?
So the testing, I'm very lucky to live on the edge of Dartmoor National Park now. So that provides, you know, some really good testing grounds. We've got, you know, a half hour climb going up Haytor, which is pretty close to, you know, you get a bit of a warm up first, thankfully, before you get to Bubby Tracy and head up. But, you know, really long climb. We've got lots of really steep climbs, backbreakers almost. It's a fabulous descent. Lots and lots and lots of...
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Gritty, try not to swear, gritty little back lanes.
I'm familiar with those. I live on the Somerset Devon border, and yeah, I'm familiar with those.
Yeah, lots of those. Very high hedges, which come in quite handy when it's very windy. And then also this like beautiful, sublime moorland tarmac right across the open. Oh, fabulous.
Not biased at all.
Not at all biased. Not at all. Don't come to Dartmoor, it's terrible. So a real mixed bag. And all three of these are sort of endurance focused. So that was really suited the fact that, you know, they've got this, you know, it's not all just like premium race circuit kind of stuff. The only thing that we don't really have on Dartmoor is flat.
yeah, you're either going up or down.
Yeah, yeah. So that was a really good test bed. And you know, just with any category, really testing these bikes in terms of their climbing, their descending, their handling, even a little bit of off-road, because, you know, it's good to just dabble.
Sure, absolutely.
Just in case for the classics lovers out there. Yeah, so that was the testing process, really.
And which of those two finished third and second, and why?
So in second and third place, I think the third place was a bit more obvious. I had really, really high hopes for the Livered Veil Advanced 1. I thought that I was going to tick all my boxes, you know, really beautiful wide gear range, which I really need around here. In fact, they all had really wide gear range, which is great. The fit didn't quite gel at first, but I had a good chat with the supplier. And actually, you can, and this is really fascinating, and I haven't come across it before, you can rotate the saddle clamp 180 degrees.
Yeah.
And it changes the saddle offset by 20 mil.
It does, yes. It's like, the same on Warren and I have PCRs, and it's exactly the same. Yeah. It's really good because, as you say, like it basically switching from a setback to an inline seat post without having to pay for anything. It's a great
feature.
For
somebody who often struggles with reach, I think I must have quite short arms. that was amazing. So that did certainly help. But I think, and we spoke about this a little bit, it just lacked the like, pizzazz that the other bikes had, and I think that's mainly down to the tyre choice. So they're fairly wide rims. All three bikes, interestingly, were spec'd with 32 mil tyres, but because they were on quite wide rims, they actually measured up at 34, and it was the Giant Gavia Fondo 1 tyres. I think they were just not the same level of performance tyres as the others had, so it just didn't quite have that.
Yeah, and it can make such a big difference, can't it?
Yeah. So that was in third. Of course, you know, if it's a bike that you're interested in, you know, it's quite an easy swap to switch out tyres,
yes.
which is, you know, saving grace. And then in second, so I really struggled to choose actually between the Scott and the Ribble. Very different bikes. The Scott was very much at the sort of racier end of the, in terms of like geometry and the ride feel of the endurance category. The Ribble, I just loved. I just really loved it. And I think I'm biased because I'm mostly, well, maybe, you know, just a bit over a third, ride gravel bikes. And it's leaning towards the gravel sort of geometry more than the racier side. So I felt very comfortable in that. I had a 40 centimetre wide handlebar and just quite a long wheelbase and just felt really planted and stable and I could corner really well. And I think the first day I went out on it, I had a stonking tailwind going up Hay-Tor.
Well, I was
going to say, didn't it? Yeah.
Well, I read,
and I got a massive PR. And
I was
going
to say, I read your review, and obviously, you know, despite that thing, you commented it wasn't slowing you down, right? So it was kind of like easy to ride. It could go off road, but it was also fast on the road, and it just had that good mix of all of those characteristics.
Yeah, and like just little things, like if you want to take it bikepacking because it's titanium, you don't really have to worry about, you know, heli tape and then ripping your paint off when you take that off afterwards. I don't know, maybe I'm just very vain, but I really loved that bike. But then I just thought, what is the essence of this test? It's about, you know, women's road bikes, and while that's really versatile, I couldn't get over the fact that the Scott is such a tidy, well put together bike at 2.5 grand. Like, it's gorgeous, and you know, it's really easy to turn your nose up at 105, but I would 100% own that bike. Like, and it was just so sleek.
It's really,
like,
really good looking bike.
It's just such a tidy package. And yeah, I know 2.5 grand is still a lot of money, but compared to some of the bikes on the market these days, it's an absolute steal.
It really is.
I took it out at the weekend.
I mean, I think
testing finished ages ago, but
yeah. I think Scott needs a bit of love for that, actually, because for years and years, Scott, you always looked at them and went, oh, really nice bike. Bit on the premium side, at every single level. But you know, that Contessa just looked remarkable value for money. And the bike I did recently, which was the Adit Gravel 20, I think.
Again, that's a fair point.
Fabulous value for money, stunning package. And you just thought, wow, Scott have really, you know, really upped their game when it comes to good value bikes now.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right about, you know, 105 still being every inch like a performance group set.
Well, thanks very much, Catherine. I would very much like to do that podcast on, you know, women's road bikes and kind of where they're going in the future. I think that's a really interesting point. And it's something that we should discuss further in a future podcast and maybe even a feature.
You've been booked.
There we go. I'll be back.
Right, so let's move on to the aero category. Now, I had the pleasure of doing this one. Now,
how'd it go?
It went really well, thank you. And I think, you know, just in general, obviously, aero road bikes are kind of increasingly designed to be race bikes. And so all of the bikes that I tested were pretty much, you know, well, they were all carbon fiber frames and forks, you know, obviously. But you know, most of them had carbon wheels, electronic group sets as well on every single one. Obviously, you know, the kind of, as the kind of category name suggests, they were all focused on being fast.
Sure.
In terms of bikes on test, I had a Giant Propel. I had a Ribble Ultra SLR, which some of you may recognize as kind of, you know, the really wild aero bike with the kind of funky bulbous handlebar. So that was an exciting one to finally test. We had the Trek Madone SLR, the latest one with the hole in its seat tube. So again, more kind of funky aero features. I also had the latest 3T Strada ICR. I also had the latest Cervelo Soloist as well. Now, you know, all of these were very, very good bikes, and you know, it's hard to kind of separate them. My top three were the Trek Madone, the Ribble, and the Giant. Now, in terms of testing, you know, as kind of everyone else has said, I live in South Bristol and I basically ride on the same roads all the time, and I just take them out on my kind of favorite loops. Climbs, descents, flats, false flats, all of these sorts of things. And you know, when you're riding these roads back to back to back to back to back, you get that real impression for how each compares. And I think the top three, you know, stood out. The Ribble especially stood out for just how incredibly fast it was. Catherine touched on it earlier about the kind of customization options that Ribble offers. And one of the things that you can get with the Ribble Ultra SLR is a very kind of pro-spec handlebar, which has basically it's a kind of integrated handlebar stem, and it features a 140mm equivalent stem length and a 33cm wide bar at the hoods with a 37 on the drops. Now, you know, for someone like me who's very narrow-shouldered, this was just perfect. And I just couldn't believe how fast this bike was. It was set up with Zip 404 Firecrest wheels, Conti GP 5000 tires. You know, I mean, it was a pretty hefty bike, like, you know, well over 8 kilos with Ultegra DI2. But I just, like, I don't think I've ridden a faster road bike.
Which is high praise considering you've tested the S5,
I've tested Cannondale System 6, Cervelo S5, Trek, you know, obviously a Trek Madone SLR7 in this test as well. And, you know, I just couldn't believe how fast it was. Now, it wasn't my category winner, basically because it is just so specialised.
I found something similar with the Ultra SL, which is essentially the same frame set. It comes out the same moulds. It's just slightly different carbon layups, as you might expect, a little bit heavier, although they say it's equally as stiff. But obviously, you get a standard level handlebar. I would say level, not like horizontal. Yeah. It's the internal brand name of Ribble, and I found the same. Although that bar is slightly more easy to live with, and that was actually 42cm wide.
You could change it,
Of course, you could.
It's less extreme.
It's less extreme, but the whole bike, that bike as a whole is so rigid and so uncompromising in almost every situation other than perfect tarmac that you feel that, you know, it becomes a punishment at times. At worst, it becomes a punishment. And you know, if you're light enough and fit enough and strong enough to be able to handle it, you're going to love it, right? And I think it's probably the same for you when you had the SLR,
yeah,
right?
So I think for me, obviously, because, I think Warren's tested the Zip 404 wheels, and like you kind of said in your review, because they've got that super wide internal width, and then compared with the 28C GP5000, so, you know, plump up to kind of 30 mils wide.
Yeah.
So for someone like me who only weighs, you know, 64, 65 kilos.
Oh, go on.
All I mean is that I can very easily run, you know, low tire pressures without any risk of ever hitting
a
rim.
Yeah.
And so that can kind of account for a lot of that, you know, frame stiffness. And you know, and obviously, if you go off onto a broken farm track, then the bike is rigid, you're good. But it's just not designed for that sort of thing. But it was the type of bike that made me think, like, you know, with, you know, cycling time trials, for example, having a road bike category in every time trial race in the UK, I should get rid of my time trial bike and just have this road bike and do that. But then obviously, you know, that's quite an abstract way of forcing a bike into my house, right? So the flip side is that it isn't the type of bike I'd want to take on a kind of holiday to the Alps or to visit my parents. Now, I had talked a little bit about the Trek. You know, as you'd expect, the Trek was fantastic. It handled excellently. You know, it's got that really interesting, innovative hole in the seat post, you know, or the seat tube, sorry.
And we use the word innovative, not lightly, do we? It's
usually
a banned word in radar towers, but
it's
different.
It's very different, and it catches a lot of attention. You know, I like the kind of the front end and the way they've kind of made it slightly narrower without going kind of, you know, too off-piste. You know, it's kind of more usable for kind of every single person. There's also the option to swap in a non-integrated front end if you wanted. You know, my only problem with it is it's over £10,000 for an Ultegra DI2.
I mean, that name alone is what I'm really intrigued by.
Yeah.
You know, we haven't had one in the office that we're fitting yet, which is annoying because the previous gen, the double isospeed equipped Madone, was... I've talked about, you know, not having, you know, not ever wanting to own an aero road bike. That's the exception that proves the rule, because that was an aero road bike that was weirdly comfortable.
Yeah.
And I thought it was fantastic. It carried a little bit more weight, but it's an aero bike. It does. You know.
Yeah. And I don't think it slows it down at all. So the Trek Madone is, you know, it is undoubtedly a fantastic bike. It's just that, you know, it's a bit, you know, and Trek aren't the only brand that has this, you know, problem in inverted commas. You know, Specialized the same, Pinarello is the same. You just have to pay a lot of money to get a bike that says Trek on the down tube, because it had a, you know, a slightly similar but slightly worse build than the Ribble, for example. The Ribble cost £6,500 and the Trek cost 10, you know, and I thought the Ribble was, you know, obviously I can't actually quantify it, I haven't been to the wind tunnel, but I felt like the Ribble was a slightly faster bike, probably because of that, you know, extremely narrow, handlebar setup and the slightly better tyres that it has. So it's difficult then to justify saying, well, you should spend £4,000 more on the Trek when, you know, that's a car to take, you know, to drive exactly, you to the race or whatever. So my category winner was the Giant Propel Advance Pro. It has that excellent balance of, you know, it feels like an aero road bike in terms of how fast it is, but it's also not super heavy. It's very comfortable. It's got plenty of tire clearance. It doesn't have a handlebar that is, you know, wildly extreme, or you won't be able to customize it. You know, you can change the stem length, you can change the handlebar width. It's, you know, it kind of looks like a relatively normal bike as well, which I think is important for a lot of people. It doesn't have that problem that, you know, I talked about with the Ribble descending Cheddar. Like, it doesn't feel like a hard working bike to ride. And it's just, you know, in a typical Giant fashion, I mean, obviously you've talked a little bit about Giant already in this podcast. It's just fantastic value. You know, the kit is nearly flawless. You get a power meter with it, which you don't on the other two. And yeah, it's just very, very hard to criticize.
Funny you say that, actually, because I fairly recently tried the new EnviLiv, which is the Liv, the women's specific sort of equivalent of that bike. And as someone who doesn't routinely ride aero bikes, I really got on with it. And I thought it was actually remarkably comfortable. And yeah, I went up for a group ride with a club in Exeter that I'd never ridden with before. And it was pacey. And I was very glad I was on that bike. But yeah, I was kind of blown away. I thought that riding an aero bike would be like quite, you know, like you said, unforgiving, sort of very, very overly stiff. And actually, I could see myself riding, you know, I don't need to own one, but really enjoy that experience. So interesting to hear that came out on top.
So let's move on. Now we're going to come to you, Ash, next, and we're going to talk about performance road bikes. And so as before, any kind of general comments on the category to make, and what bikes did you test?
Well, the comment I'd make about the category as a whole is, up until about the 11th hour, we were calling it the race category and the race all-rounder category. And then we switched it to performance to sort of encompass kind of a broader spectrum of bike, even though they're all very, very similar, to be honest. And it's interesting, as we just mentioned as well, with aero bikes, you know, you're getting traditionally lightweight bikes have become more aero, and everything's kind of, you've got that Venn diagram where everyone sort of wants to sit in the middle for most of their bikes and race bikes. And you see a lot of them on the world tour scene. So when I was looking for the bikes we wanted to test here, you know, I actually had an embarrassment of riches to kind of choose from on the market. Not all bikes were available. I couldn't get, for example, a Canyon Ultimate, which I felt would have been a good fit for this category. And I'm sure, you know, many listeners might agree with that. But, you know, we had five bikes that came in that, you know, kind of slightly varied in their approach, but we had a Cannondale Super 6 Evo, the latest one that Warren first rode for us out in Spain. Was it, Warren? You got out to Spain for that one. The Villa SL has been around for a little while now, but it was a bike we hadn't seen before, and it's actually quite interesting in terms of the way Villa does, you know, has a kind of Italian approach to race bike design. Another Italian brand, we had the Colnago V4 RS. How could we not have Tadej Pogačar's bike? The bike that's almost been designed for him, I suppose, in the sort of race all rounder slash performance category. A Basso Diamante, which we first saw at Eurobike last year. And that had seen a few updates. But what was really nice about that bike and intriguing is that it doesn't really have any aero nods on it. So it's really a kind of slim tubed climbing race oriented bike. And we also had an Envy Melee as well, which is actually not a complete bike. You can have it as a frame set and then you build up your bike around that. We had our local distributor here, Envy distributor, build up the bike for us with Envy compatible parts. We didn't go overboard, so it's in line with the kind of prices that we saw. So Envy Foundation 45 wheels on, which are kind of, in terms of design, around about, you know, your standard sort of road wheel set design. And yeah, we just built it up from there, really. And Warren and I kind of, we can both ride it. So I know Warren's looking forward to taking that one out for a spin soon as well, when it comes back to me after filming. So yeah, it's we had a good mix.
How do you like to test your bikes, Ash?
I like to ride them the way I just like to ride bikes, to be honest. I get most out of it doing that. If I'm trying, it's what I've come to call, I'm sure I'm not the only one to have thought this, but I've come to call it tester's bias. If I'm testing it in a very specific way and it doesn't align with the way I ride a bike. Now, I tend to ride the racy type bikes anyway. I've always owned racy type bikes. So, you know, for the length and the speed and the efficiency and so on. So I tend to take them out on certain loops. I do sort of what I call speed runs. I'll also do rides where I'm not actually thinking about riding fast at all, and I'm just going out to ride them.
So what bikes made your top three, Ash?
Number three came the Colnago V4 RS. That may surprise some people. It's probably one of the most headline-making bikes with one of the most headline-making riders on it at the moment. And when we were filming, actually, one of our colleagues, Jack Evans, helped us out to some of the YouTube filming. You've head over there and watch us riding the bikes and covering it there. He was able to ride a few of the different bikes that I tested here. And he said, I think this is the one I'd have over the short time that he had with it. And I think because he's slightly taller than I am.
Realize Jack get paid that well.
Yeah, exactly. Well, if you want to know how much that bike costs, it's 12,630 euros.
See, that's my only issue with it. It's like, it's a great looking bike, really nice bike. It's obviously got the pedigree of lots and lots of victories.
Sure, yeah.
But I think I'd go for a C68.
I know what you mean.
Because it's, if you're spending 12, you might as well spend 14. And there's, with the C68, you're getting that more exclusivity, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah. It's you are. I can't stress enough. The V4 RS is a devilishly quick bike, and it does a great impression of an aero bike. Yet, it's really strange how they've. I can't quite work out how they've managed to do it. And Colnago, when they sent us the press details about the bike and me some more details about it as well, couldn't quite tell us exactly where it was fast against who and why and so on. They were slightly woolly around that subject, but I can tell you when I've been riding it on, you know, very high quality Dura-Ace C50 wheels, so not the Envy's that Pogacar's riding around on, it's intoxicatingly quick. And it's a really easy bike to handle, easy really bike to descend on. You know, it's one of the best race/performance bikes you can get out there today. There's no question about that. But it is incredibly expensive, and you are certainly paying the Colnago tax, if we want to call it that. So my final two, that it was incredibly close to call my final two, and it comes down to the Americans that I had in the stable. I had obviously a Cannondale Super 6 Evo, and had an MV Melee, and I engaged Warren in a bit of a conversation about this. I'm just not sure which one it should go to. And I suppose if I were buying a bike, and many, you know, we're just buying a bike with my head, I might be 51-49 in favor of the Cannondale Super 6. However, we don't always do that. And the Envy Melee offered just something a little bit more, just in a tight, what feels like a slightly tidier design somehow in terms of its proportions, just visually, and the way it rides, it's just a little bit more comfortable, a little bit more docile, which you might think is a bad thing, but actually it just gives you confidence compared to the Super 6. But if you love a razor sharp bike but it's still predictable, but you love that razor sharp handling, then the Super 6 is still, it's every inch the bike that it always has been for the last few generations. And I've loved previous generations of the Super 6. I know, Warren, you have as well. And it's, you know, it's right up there for you. And yeah, it still should be. It still should be. And it was a real tough thing to split them. The Super 6 is a little bit better value. You're talking Ultegra DI2 with, you know, hologram, I think they're SL45 wheels on there, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly now. And they, I mean, you'd never need to upgrade them. The bike comes fitted with Clincher Continental GP5000 tyres. I think, although as excellent as those tyres are, I think it's a real shame that they don't come with tubeless tyres as standard. If there's one objective thing that I could poke at it, I'd be going to a Cannondale dealer or a shop and saying, would you mind swapping those out for me for STRs? And if they do it for you, then you've got all the bikes.
That's the thing when I was riding it on the launch. Obviously, I mean, you know, I put my hand up and say I own the previous generation Super 6 Evo, and it's very, very similar. It's just that little bit lighter, a little bit more Evo, a little bit more evolved. But I did find, you know, riding it out, you know, around the roads and the hills around Girona, this bike is fabulous. But I still had the one criticism. I was like, why are you still putting 25C tires on it?
Mm. Yeah.
It was kind of, and it was a criticism I had when they launched, not the last generation Synapse, the Synapse before. Mm. And I was riding that out in Italy. Mm. And again, I had 25C tires. So I said, this is stupid. Why are you running 25C tires? Mm. And it's kind of, you know, the thing I got was, oh, it's to appeal to that kind of mainland European, you know, accepted standard of things. But with that Synapse, when they brought it to the UK, they did UK spec and put 28s on it. And I think if they do that with it, they should do that with the Evo, because a 25 mil tire on our terrible roads just feels shockingly out of date. And it for what is an absolutely cutting edge bike, you know, if you're lucky enough to live everywhere that's got super smooth, beautiful blacktop, and 25s are still a great choice. But for everywhere else, it's kind of...
There's no arguments there, is there?
No.
Yeah. It'd be like turning up for 100 metres sprint in, you know, bally slippers.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I'm by no means saying... I mean,
it's not the only thing.
No, of course.
But it's one of those things that... It's an obvious one. Yeah, it's an obvious thing that I, you know, even I riding it on great roads and in Spain thought, you know, if it just... Just that tweak, and then it'll be ramping everything up. As great as the bike is,
sure. It's easier to live with now, I think, as well. I think the design's been eased, so you can swap in different parts and headsets. Threaded BBs. That's going to be a win for many people as well. But you know, Warren, I know you made the comment when you first rode it. So it's brilliant. If I were in the market for a new bike, I'd be right there for it, with, among others. But at the same time, it hasn't moved it along enough that I'm thinking, well, mine.
Yeah, I don't want to chop my Evo in for it. Yeah.
No, exactly. No. And I think in when I then looked at the Melee and I saw what that offered, so it was slightly different. And I thought, as much as not moving the game forward necessarily, but I thought it offered something that was different, something that was sort of, there's a luxury edge to the NV brand, but actually it's really functional and it's really fast in all conditions. I could go over, you know, chip top tarmac and broken stuff, and I could ride through it, and it would treat me well, and I'd maintain my speed with just a little bit more ease than I could on the Super 6. And there are many places in the world where people live on really smooth tarmac and so on, and that's great, and perhaps the Super 6 would be faster in that situation. But if you're looking for that kind of all-round sparkle where it just can't be outdone, I wouldn't even be surprised if I could take it on some very light, the MV Melee on some very light gravel and still really, really enjoy it. Pump some, you know, put some slightly bigger tires on it, job done. And I just, it just stood out to me in a way that I actually find very difficult to quantify. I hope it comes across in my reviews when you go and read them on bikeradar.com. But you know, there's no doubt it's an expensive bike. I was in two minds thinking, can I really award that, you know, in a cost of living crisis in the UK and, you know, prices rising everywhere, you know, can I really award a bike that, you know, when it's all specced up the way I had it specced up, and that's by no means, you know, dipping deepest into the parts bin, you know, at £10,400, it's a lot of money. Mm. It's a lot of money. But I came away from the test thinking, I think this is the bike that I covet the most.
Sure.
I rode it because it was delivered to me.
Sure. Yeah, well, there is that. Yeah.
But only briefly. I mean, I didn't put too much into it, but I rode it and I would agree. I just felt at home. You just felt, this is really good. It's just good, solid. It holds no surprises, and you just felt comfortably fast all the time.
Sure.
You know, whereas as much as I love bikes like the TCR and the Evo, there will occasionally snap. They will bite back, on that rare occasion, because they are so rapid to respond.
Sure.
You know, whereas the MB was just that kind of, you know, it's like a very fast four-wheel drive Audi compared to a, you know, leery rear-wheel drive Porsche.
It's the golden retriever of bikes.
It's a bit more exciting than the golden retriever.
Oh, don't say that. Listen, I got a 15-week-old puppy at home.
Had to get the puppy in.
I really did. I haven't had an opportunity to this point, so I'm going to do it now. Anyway, final category.
Yes, our final category, endurance road bikes was. Now, you know, obviously you touched on gravel bikes right at the start of this podcast and how they're, you know, that's in a kind of, you know, constant state of flux. Now, endurance road bikes is one category that is, you know, has arguably seen a lot of its territory encroached on by gravel. How did you choose bikes for this one?
I mean, it's one of those things that I would say, you know, I've been around endurance bikes since they were, you know, first conceived, as it were. But the endurance bike is having something of a, I would say, an identity crisis. Mm. Basically being squeezed from both ends. You know, the kind of performance end of road bikes are getting more comfortable.
Even aero road bikes have big clearances these days, right?
The tyre clearances are there. And gravel bikes are getting lighter and more aggressive. So it's literally being squeezed from both sides. So is an endurance bike today a relaxed race bike, or is it a tamed gravel bike? You know, and I kind of wanted this category to reflect that. And so I did, I don't know, kind of went out on a limb on a few choices here. First off, I had the Villa Gran Turismo SLR, a new bike, which I think you rode on when it launched.
I did, yes.
And that's got like a elastomer, or a 3D printed elastomer infused rear end, you know, which we've seen similar from BMC on a URS gravel bike. Then I had the Cervelo Caledonia. Then I had the Merida Sculptura Endurance, which looks like a traditional bike. There's no drop stays on this. It's a standard, you know, two triangles. It looks fairly classic. And Merida, great brand for bang for buck. So I wanted those to be in there. Then there's the Vitus Venon Evo, which is a brand new bike. I've kind of tracked the progress of this bike and its development. And I had an early prototype of it about a year ago, which I've ridden around a bit. I've been out to meet their engineering team. And this is a bike in the kind of mold of Ridley's Griffin, which is an endurance bike, which you can also build up in a gravel spec. It's a very similar thing, even though the Venon, I think, started its development before Ridley. But that seems to be a direction that we're seeing from gravel. And then the final one is the Rondo Rat CF2. Now, Rondo actually state this bike as an endurance bike, but 99.9% of people who see it will go, that's a mad-looking gravel bike.
It looks like Robocop, doesn't it?
And it looks like Robocop, yeah. Mm. I mean, it's like a Brutalist Architect's fever dream sketch of what a bicycle should look like. And honestly, I loved it. I just loved the look of it. So, yeah, that was my five. The three that made it through to the podium places were the Cervelo, the Merida, and the Vitus.
And how did you test these bikes?
Again, because this is a long-standing kind of loop, actually, because I've done the endurance bike of the year testing, I think, for over a decade now. And so what I tend to do is I get the bike, I'll get it set up to me, and then I'll get straight out and just kind of do a high-tempo kind of 2.5-hour ride, just hitting like lots of local bits that I, you know, I enjoy, a couple of really steep short climbs, a couple of draggy climbs, that sort of thing, just to get used to the bike. But then once I've done that, then they all get ridden on the same test route, which is a 132K, 82-mile loop around Wiltshire into Somerset, taking in the kind of big local climbs that I can get. There's a couple of descents which are on semi-private roads, so you can really let go on them. And then it's just a case of re-riding back to back and just going through how they're built, what the value is, how they handle is the most important. And again, for me, it's all about the fun factor. The bikes have to be fun. You know, and I think this year's kind of endurance bike test, these five bikes I've done, I think it was in excess of 2,000 kilometres just on those. So a lot of very, very wet miles as well.
Yeah.
March is the wettest for 40 years. So, you know, these bikes cope really well in awful weather.
So talk us through your podium bikes then. Which ones finished third and second?
I would say in third place is the Cervelo Caledonia. Again, it's the Caledonia 5 is a bike I absolutely loved, because when you take a brand like Cervelo, who are absolutely steeped in racing, you know, they've never been anything else, it's exactly what you'd expect them to make of an endurance bike. So it's still got pretty quick handling responses. It's still not super tall at the front, but it's not overly slammed, and the reach is generous without being overly long. So when you want to go fast, when you want to, you know, mix it up and, you know, have a bit of a sprint on it, if you don't feel like you're fighting against it, it plays ball with you. But generous tire and clearances, good comfort levels, and you end up with a bike that's just smooth riding but speedy, and that's exactly what you want, you know. And then in second place, it's the Merida, which as an endurance bike, it absolutely stays true to tarmac. It's not about anything else. It's got the classic taller, shorter ride position that defines an endurance bike, but it's got generous tire clearances. What I really did like about it as well is that it was one of the cheapest bikes I had on test, the 3,400 Rival Axis Group set. Really good set of DT alloy wheels and shipped with Conti GP5000s. Like a premium tire on not a premium bike is a rare thing. But the other thing was they put 32 mil GP5000s on it.
Fantastic.
And they were, I thought, it's going a bit much. It's a bit big. They were a revelation, especially in the like awful weather.
Mm.
Like grip levels out of this world, comfort levels. You know, I was like completely sold on it to the point where I'm going, I wonder which of my bikes I can get 32 in now. Because it's something I really want to experiment with.
I think Merida's really good for that, as you say, that value thing though. Like I've wondered if that was going to change in the kind of like, you know, the last year and a half or so of price rises. But Merida has been one of those brands who have really kept very competitive pricing like across the board.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just been, you know, exceptionally good value for money. Couldn't put a foot wrong. Merida's contact points are really good. Fabulous, you know, Merida own brand saddle, but it's like proper, modern, short shape, super comfortable without being squishy. You know, the bars are great shape, nice compact drop. They just got every element of it right.
Yeah, and they don't skimp on the kit either. That, and yeah,
you know, and just a good all round classic endurance road bike.
So your winner,
the winner, the Vitus Venon. It's got a very long name. The Vitus Venon Evo RS Aero Force.
Wow.
But I'm just going to call it the Venon Evo. What Vitus have done here is they've achieved something really quite special. It's a bike that's I would put up there with the best endurance bikes that I've ever ridden. I'm talking Cannondale Synapse, Giant Defy, Special Roubaix, Trek Domani. But its core is versatility. It's mad that this is as good a pure endurance road bike as you'll find, but it can take a 45 mil tire. And not only that, it's got proper mudguard mounts. It's got a removable bridge. So it's even got like two position bottle cage mount, you know, bottle cage mount on the down tube. So you could effectively put a 45C tire on it, load it all with bags and do a little bit of light bike packing with it. It could be an Orduxer beyond compare because it's a light bike. It's a really light frame. You know, the XL bike that I had, it's a sub 900 gram frame. You know, everything that they've put into this bike just shows this kind of new direction that Vitas are going in. They kind of started with the ZX1, you know, this big level of in-house development. And it's quite frankly, it's exceptional. You know, it's the handling's really lively, which brings this incredible fun factor. It combines the sensible with the sensational to such an effect that it really did blow me away. And all the while they've done this at a price very few can match. You know, the bike that I've got, Force Axis, Prime Primavera 44 carbon wheels, which is a really good, new, decent modern wheel. Good width inside, tubeless ready, 1,500 grams a pair, you know. And then you've got slick carbon seat post, good saddle, an aero carbon bar. It's got the FSA ICR system on it, so everything's rooted fully internally. Beautiful tyres, Michelin Power Cup tyres. And it's doing all that for £4,699. And in context, say something like the Villiers, which a fabulous bike, absolutely fabulous, very comparable spec. So the Villiers gets carbon seat post, it gets carbon wheels, not as good as the Primes. It's Force Axis. It gets a half decent bar, although it's not a carbon bar. And the Villiers is closer to £9,000 than it is to 8,000, so it's nearly double the price.
Mm.
And the best thing about the Vitas is it doesn't feel like a value proposition. It feels every inch a premium bike, and I'm genuinely shocked at how good it is, and overwhelmingly surprised. And also the fact that it is so versatile that it's one of those things. And I'm absolutely not the person to say, hey, if you only need one bike to do a job, this is somebody homes far too many bikes. I can't think of a better choice right now than the Venon.
So we're going to, obviously the next part of this podcast was going to be talking about the overall winner. But we've just talked about it, haven't we, Waz? The overall winner was...
It is, yeah, the Vita Sven on Evo.
So how did we come to that decision?
Well, the thing is, we all came in and we all pitched our, we all pitched our corners, and then you kind of take it all into consideration. You obviously taking price and performance and everything else, into consideration. And then it's kind of like, I think, I've been on video shoots with a lot of the guys now. I've been on bike shoots with a lot of the guys now. And every conversation I've had with a wide variety of people and everybody that's been and ridden it and everything, they've all kind of gone, yeah, I think it's the one I want,
Yeah.
It's just, it's hard to explain how well it does most things. It's a properly do it or do anything kind of bike. And they should be applauded for that. Absolutely should be applauded for that.
And yeah, it's worth reinforcing as well. Your $4,000-$4,500 is going on a bike that can do all of that. And it's not like you need a specific bike for one task and then another and then another. You could take this bike, racing on your local track, or you could take it, sort of gravel.
And that's a really interesting thing with it. It's like, although it's an endurance bike, it's one of the more aggressive endurance bike geometries that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And I have spoken at length to the head of the team that put it together, Ben, and he's an incredible numbers geek, and he assembles geometries of every single bike on the market that in those particular spaces. So he's got a database and he's literally benchmarking it, and he benchmarks all of those geometries against bikes tested throughout the world from different different corners. And so he hasn't just taken these kind of arbitrary numbers that everybody says that's what an endurance bike should be. They've actually been investigating and prototyping and doing so much work behind the scenes. And I think that's a perception of that most people wouldn't have had about Vitus, As I say, I went over and visited their R&D department. It's a 40-strong team that are doing the R&D on their bikes.
Wow.
That's as big as some of the biggest guys in the industry, some of the really biggest players.
Yeah.
And I think that shows incredible where, I almost want to say courage, from a smaller brand to commit so heavily to making good bikes.
Sure.
Not just assembling good bikes.
Mm.
All right. Well, as has already been mentioned, if you would like to read all of the reviews, you can find those in Cycling Plus or on bikeradar.com. As always, thank you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast if you haven't already. And please do leave a review wherever you get your podcasts, as that helps us reach more people who are into bikes. If you have any questions or comments about what we've discussed today, you can email us at podcast@bikeradar.com. Otherwise, thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thanks.
And we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Bike Radar podcast. If you've not done so already, please subscribe and share with your friends, or leave us a rating if you've enjoyed this episode.